You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. Next up, a rocket last Sunday lifted off a Pacific atoll of the Marshall Islands and was bound for Earth orbit. But there was something very different and significant about this rocket. It was designed and built privately without government assistance. And the rocket was named the Falcon 1, built and launched by the Space Exploration Technologies Corporation, or SpaceX. It's a private company aiming to provide low-cost launch services and making a business of selling a ride into space cheaper and more reliably than previous launch techniques. Last weekend's rocket launch was the first privately designed and built system to make it, as I say, into Earth orbit. And it came after three failed attempts. Joining me now to talk about the launch and what comes next is Elon Musk. He is the founder of SpaceX and the company's CEO and CTO and has a big smile on his face, I'm sure, today. Welcome back to the program, Elon.
Thank you.
So this was the fourth charm, a charm, huh?
Yeah, I mean, I was just saying that obviously as a joke because the common idiomatic expression is third time's a charm. But this was a great success for us, and we're finally able to iron out all of the design related issues with the vehicle. In our case, it was particularly tricky because the entire vehicle was designed from the ground up. So the first stage engine, second stage engine, all the structure, avionics, guidance, control, was all done internally at SpaceX from a clean sheet. Typically, launch vehicles have a long heritage and contain, or at least many of the components have flown before, but that was not the case in our vehicle. So it took a little longer to iron out the design issues because there were so many new things.
Well, why not just license the design from someone else and build one of those rockets? Why start from the ground?
Because the designs are not good. They're very expensive, and they do not have any potential for reusability. In the case of Falcon 1, it is designed to make a substantial cost breakthrough. A lot of cost is actually there right at the design point. If you design something that is inherently expensive, it's going to be expensive. Mm. And that's typically how launch vehicles have been done in the past. We had to really start from a clean sheet to make something that was low cost to manufacture, and then also which was designed, at least in the case of the first stage, to be to have the potential for reusability. There's only one partially reusable launch vehicle in the world, and that's the shuttle. The main tank is thrown away every time, but the reusable elements of the shuttle are so expensive that it's more costly than an expendable vehicle. One of the big breakthroughs we're hoping to achieve over time is a cost-effective reusability. And so it really required that we start from a clean sheet.
1-800-989-8255, talking with Elon Musk. Are you saying that there are parts of your of the spacecraft Falcon 1 that can be reused?
The first stage is designed with the potential for reusability. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, it did not survive reentry on this flight. But we've got some good data to make improvements, and I think we've got a good shot of recovering it on flight 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm. And how about? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just saying it's a pretty tough job recovering rocket stages, which is why no one has ever succeeded in creating a fully reusable orbital launch vehicle, and why there's only one vehicle that's even partially reusable, which is the shuttle. All the other launch vehicles in the world are expendable.
You have to know where you have to send a ship to know where it's going to splash down, I imagine, pretty accurately.
To within about a 20-mile distance. Yeah.
Yeah, and then you got to fish it out of the water and make sure it doesn't sink.
The sinking's not an issue, but when the propellant when the tanks are empty, it has about the density of an empty beer can. So it's not going to sink, and it doesn't really leak or anything like that. So no danger of sinking, but there is obviously the challenge of ensuring that it does not corrode when in seawater, and that the electronics aren't damaged by seawater. Mm-hmm.
What do you foresee now as the first commercial use of your spacecraft?
Well, we have quite a few launch contracts for both government and commercial satellites for Falcon 1. Our next flight will carry a satellite for Malaysia, as well as some U.S. government secondary satellites. And that's slated to launch in approximately March.
Mm-hmm.
And that satellite will be used for monitoring for natural disaster monitoring. So if there's a flood or tsunami or fires or whatever, the Malaysia can direct aid to where it's needed. So that's the next satellite. And then we have probably two more launches, one around the middle of next year, one towards the end of next year. Probably both of those will be U.S. government launches. And maybe even an additional launch, which would be a commercial launch, for replenishment of the Orbcomm constellation.
And there's going to be a time where the in between space shuttles, where we're not going to have a space shuttle to use to service the space station, right? Can you fill that gap with your space vehicles?
Yeah, absolutely. So the shuttle is slated to retire in 2010. About 2 years ago, NASA held a competition for commercial servicing of the space station after the shuttle retires. SpaceX won that contract, won the first three or four parts of the contract, which are to take pressurized and unpressurized cargo to the space station and return it to Earth. There's a fourth element to that contract, which NASA has not yet exercised, but we hope that they will, and we do think it's in the best interest of the country, and I think they will, which is to upgrade our Dragon spacecraft to carry people. So in which case the United States would not need to rely on the Soyuz for carrying people to the space station between 2010 and 2015 or whenever the next NASA developed system is available.
Hmm.
So we're expecting to do our first demonstration flight of our Falcon 9 booster, which is our big booster, and our Dragon spacecraft, which is what will go and dock with the space station next year. And then there are a couple more demonstrations in 2010, at which point we'll go operational.
1-800-989-8255. Talking with Elon Musk of the SpaceX Corporation. So you're saying that it's possible that you could create a little module where people could be sitting in and go back and forth to the space station? Or would they just stay with it while it's up there and keep docked with it at the space station?
They would. Actually, we'll be releasing a video probably in a week or two that'll give people a very clear illustration of what it is we're talking about. And there's already some information on our website at spacex.com. So if people are curious to see what it is we're referring to, that you can see actual pictures of hardware on the SpaceX website. But essentially, it's sort of a capsule-like architecture. It takes up to seven astronauts to the space station. It can remain attached to the space station for 6 months or more if need be, or it can immediately return to Earth with the seven astronauts.
Wow. And are you part of the Lunar X Prize competition? The X Prize will be to put a payload, a working payload, on the moon.
Well, I'm actually a trustee of the XPRIZE and helped fund the original suborbital XPRIZE that Bert Rutan won, and actually have partly helped fund this prize in that SpaceX has offered to do any launches for that XPRIZE at zero profit. So we'll do it just at our cost, and that's just to help teams be able to do that. That mission. So we ourselves are not going to attempt to do the mission.
Mm-hmm. So that they can use one of your rockets to get to the moon.
Yes.
Yeah, but they come up with the payload themselves.
Yeah.
What kind of time frame do you think all of this is going to happen? And are you going to be getting in? If you can carry people to the space station, why not carry people into Earth orbit and make a business out of that as space tourists?
Absolutely. I think we'll do trips to the space station with NASA astronauts and private astronauts, and we will carry private astronauts to Earth orbit if they wish. And then there's also potential for doing some interesting missions like a loop around the moon. We wouldn't have the capability to actually land on the moon, but potentially could sort of loop around the moon, and people could see the backside of the moon and maybe go even a little further than was the case with Apollo.
1-800-989-8255. Crystal in Portland, Oregon. Hi, Crystal.
Hi there.
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering how much commercial private space travel would increase what we already have and what kind of effect it would have on global warming, what kind of carbon footprint. How much gas would it take to make one flight of, say, of space tourists?
There's quite a bit of energy needed to get to orbit. However, the number of flights that take place is so tiny that it doesn't even factor in terms of carbon emissions. Also, I should point out we buy carbon offsets for all of our launches. Actually, well in excess of the carbon that we create, because I'm very much an environmentalist. Mm-hmm. So I mean, even if we didn't buy carbon offsets, it's really such a tiny, tiny portion of the carbon that's created. It doesn't even register.
Thank you, Crystal. Could you make your rocket fuel out of algae, like Richard Branson wants to make his jet fuel out of?
It's certainly conceivable. You could make the fuel we use is rocket propellant grade kerosene, which is basically a high purity jet fuel. Mm-hmm. So our vehicle taking off is like a medium-sized jet taking off. I mean, that's about as much fuel as we use, equivalent to one medium-sized jet flight.
Mm-hmm. Bauer in Second Life asks, why did the first attempts fail, and how much did the failures cost altogether, and to whom? And why did these ones work? I'll add that.
Sure. We had basically three design-related issues with the first three flights. And by the way, flights 2 and 3 made it to space. So I should distinguish between orbit and space, because mm-hmm. flights 2 and 3 certainly made it well beyond the boundary of space, but they just did not reach full orbital velocity. Mm-hmm. And it's much, much harder to reach full orbital velocity than it is simply to get to space. To get to the boundary of space, you only need about, 2% of the energy you need to get to orbit.
Wow.
So if you compare the energy capability of our vehicles with, say, Spaceship One, which is what was used to win the Suborbital X Prize, or Spaceship Two, which is what Virgin Galactic will be doing, then we're about 50 times the energy of those vehicles. Hmm. But for Flight One, the issue was basically a corroded nut, and that was because we'd inadvertently used a stress corrosion prone alloy of aluminum, and it happened to be in a high corrosion environment. So our test stand was in sort of a normal environment, but out there on the island, it's a high corrosion environment. So that made we encountered an issue that we just didn't see on the test stand, which was very rapid corrosion of a nut. Mm-hmm. So we took corrective action after that. Then flight two, the problem was that. Was with control of the second stage, which is a tricky thing to figure out, because it's going at it goes from Mach 10 to Mach 25 in a vacuum, and accelerating from just under 1 G to over 5 Gs. So there's no way to really test that well you can't really test that on the ground. You can only model it. And unfortunately, we had modeled it incorrectly.
All right, hang on. Elon, let me jump in and remind everybody that this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Sorry about that. Go ahead.
No problem. So the corrective action there was to install slosh baffles, which basically prevent the liquid oxygen in that liquid oxygen tank from sloshing around, and also to change some of the gains and the algorithms in the control system. Mm-hmm. And The problem is a bit like if you're trying to run carrying a bowl of soup.
It sloshes around a lot. All right, let's go to number three. What happened with number three?
So number three, number three would have worked if we had kept the same first stage engine as flight two, but we upgraded the engine because we wanted to use the engine on flight three that we planned to use in our big vehicle Falcon 9 and get flight history on that before mm-hmm. before using it on our big vehicle, and unfortunately the thrust transient, which is the during shutdown, which is basically the rate at which the thrust, how the thrust decays over time, was a much longer thrust decay than the old engine, and so after we separated the stages, the first stage actually still had residual thrust, and basically kept on going forward and rear-ended the second stage.
I hate it when that happens.
Right.
Yeah.
See, tailgating.
Yeah. So you fixed that for number four.
And we basically made a very small timing change to basically extend the time from when we initiate main engine cutoff to second stage to stage separation. We just increased that by a few seconds and solved the problem, and we got to orbit.
Yeah. So for all those people who thought they couldn't understand rocket science, there it is in just about a minute and a half. I got about 30 seconds left, Elon. Where do you go next?
Well, we have a bunch of exciting things happening with Falcon 9. We're going to have Falcon 9 at Cape Canaveral in December, and we hope to do our first launch around the middle of this year, and then followed shortly by our first launch for NASA, which will be a test flight of our Dragon spacecraft. So that's going to be very exciting. I think the SpaceX is really going to make a big difference to the space program and make sure we're not reliant on the Russians after 2010.
Well, we'll see you at the Cape.
All right.
Elon Musk, who is the founder of SpaceX and the company's CEO and CTO, thanks for taking time to be with us today. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, come back, change gears one more time, and talk about, things that appear to be what they are, but they're not really. So you don't even appear to know what I'm talking about. Well, you'll find out more after this break, so stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News.